Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, Governor Roy Cooper takes his name off the list of people being considered by Kamala Harris as possible running mates. Meanwhile, the political landscape has changed dramatically. Voter registration is up. Harris is planning her eighth appearance in the state, and she and Trump start buying TV ads here, proving we are still a battleground state. The vote is coming up on whether the city will ante up and buy Norfolk Southern's O-line tracks for the Red Line. Charlotte's plan to reduce traffic fatalities, Vision Zero, is falling short, and a sexual assault case involving a former student at CMS, which we have been following here for years, is rejected by an appeals court judge. Here to talk about those stories and more is Andos Helms, WFAE's education reporter. Ben Thompson is here again. He's an anchor at WCNC-TV and host of their Sunday morning program, Flashpoint. Joe Bruno is a reporter for WSOC-TV and host of their Political Beat program, also on Sunday morning. It's the battle of the TV hosts. And Alexandria Sands is a reporter for Axios. Charlotte, good morning and welcome to you all.
Good morning.
Welcome. Happy Friday.
Yes. Hey, the field of possible VP nominees to run with Kamala Harris has been reduced. North Carolina Governor Roy Cooper has withdrawn his name from the race. He was in the list of the top 12, and I heard at one point he was in the top six candidates. In fact, he was at one point rumored to be the leading candidate. So why did he take himself out? Who wants to take that? Go ahead, Alex.
What we're hearing is there were multiple reasons, but one of them seems to be just the concern of what Lieutenant Governor Mark Robinson would do if Roy Cooper was out of the state a lot campaigning. There's also a little bit of talk going on about what could be next for Roy Cooper. Now that we know he's not going to be vice president. And there's some talk that maybe he'll go up against Tillis in 2026 for U.S. Senate.
Does he have a chance against Tillis in North Carolina in a Senate race in 2 years?
Well, yeah, he's probably the best recruit.
He's never lost an election.
I think the bigger question would be, does Tillis get through the primary? Because time and time again, there have been threats of people running to the right of him, and he's done some things, and he's been censured by his own party. So if Tillis runs again, does he get through the primary? And then after that, would he could he take on Roy Cooper, who, as Alex refers to, never lost her election?
To the best of my knowledge, when Roy Cooper made this decision, he simply put out a statement. That's it. He's never spoken to the media about this. He's never really explained anything beyond he's not running. He's taking himself out of the race. Does that strike anybody as odd that he's offered no explanation, Joe?
I do believe he did speak to Wilmington television stations in the woods somewhere in Brunswick County. I don't know why he was out there, but he basically just kind of reiterated his statement that it isn't the right time for him to be considered for this position. And from what it sounds like, he kind of took himself out of the running early, which is a surprise because he would have been a strong candidate for that role.
Ben. Yeah, it just sounds like he wasn't ever actually vetted to begin with. We thought he'd been vetted at this point, but it sounds now he spoke to those cameras in the woods with the EPA administrator there in Brunswick County. He said that he had dropped himself out of the race before he was actually even vetted. So I think it's fair to assume there's a variety of things at play here. And I wouldn't, even though I don't know this firsthand, wouldn't discount the idea that maybe having a longstanding relationship with Kamala Harris, something was said to him early on, saying, you're not going to be the one, or, hey, you're not going to get to the top two, and allow somebody, this happens frequently, allow somebody to save face, let them go out on their own terms.
Made me think of all the times when superintendent candidates used to go before the public, and you'd have three people, and they'd all come tell you they were wonderful, and like a day before the announcement, somebody would say, you know, I've decided I really like my district. I'm taking myself out of the running.
Right.
And you knew they'd gotten the word.
Sure.
But I want to come back to one of the concerns that has been speculated about, and that is if he had to run for vice president, he'd be on the campaign trail a lot, and that would take him out of the state. And under North Carolina law, the lieutenant governor becomes the acting governor, Is that really a serious concern? I mean, I know he's been out of the state in the past, and there have been some attempts by the lieutenant governor, who's running for governor, Mark Robinson, to pull a fast one here and there. But isn't it immediately overridden by the real governor when he returns? Joe, you had your hand up for a second.
I don't buy that as a real excuse, I guess. If that's a concern, I have a hard time understanding why, because Cooper has gone to Japan. Like, he's gone out of the country before. And the most Mark Robinson has done is issue a proclamation in support of Israel. Mark Robinson right now is kind of laying low too and avoiding the media. So he hasn't been really out and about in public and doing all of these things. And really, if Republicans want to do something, nothing is stopping them. They have a supermajority. They can already do whatever they want if they have consensus. So I don't think Mark Robinson would really make a huge difference if Roy Cooper had to hold an event in Michigan.
I think that aside from Roy Cooper having a relationship with Kamala Harris, dating back to their time as state attorney generals in California and North Carolina, there is the fact that of the states with governors mentioned as possible vice presidential candidates, North Carolina has the second largest number of electoral votes. The largest number is the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. And that is where Josh Shapiro is the governor. And he's still on the list. And I heard this week that he has canceled several key appearances this weekend. Does that tell us anything? Because she promises to bring with her to North Carolina next Thursday her vice presidential nominee.
I mean, I wouldn't read too much into that. I think he is clearly the odds-on favorite. And the first campaign stop next week is in Philadelphia. So again, that looks like that might lean towards him. But I think evidently he's had his schedule canceled this weekend. Governor Walz, Minnesota has hit as well. Pete Buttigieg, all these people, well, at least several of them have had to cancel their weekend plans. It sounds like they might be getting together for a final round.
They're sitting around the campfire like Survivor. They'll have to make fire.
Okay. Make a great reality TV show.
Meanwhile, the presidential campaign is in full swing, and evidently North Carolina is very much in play. At least that's what we're told. At least Democrats are making moves to make us believe so. Vice President Harris is scheduled to visit North Carolina, I think the Raleigh or the Triangle area, next Thursday. Some reporters say that she will have her vice presidential choice in tow. What else do we know about that visit?
Well, I think you said about all we know right
okay.
now.
All
research
right.
triangle. It is her eighth visit of the year, which is really incredible to think about. We're here in August. We've still got several months to go, and she's been here eight times in North Carolina alone. They really do feel like North Carolina is a state they could pick up. And Trump is now playing defense. He invested a pretty large media buy now to get on the air. So Trump's campaign certainly thinks North Carolina could go either way because they're investing money in it.
She's raised in excess of $300 million in just a short amount of time, less than 2 weeks. And I think it's more than double what President Trump has raised in that same amount of time. Now she and her challenger are spending advertising dollars as a result of that. And they're spending a lot of it here. Nationally, Politico reports the Harris campaign launched an ad called Fearless, describing her as such, while the Trump campaign is running an ad portraying her as failed with regard to her handling of the border crisis on behalf of the Biden administration. Are those ads running here?
They are. I actually saw the Trump ad about 30 minutes ago on our air. The Harris ad you mentioned was already previously planned, even when Mr. Biden was running. The Trump ad, that is new. That was not planned, but it points to the fact that this is now, once again, a battleground state. The ad by Mr. Trump says that it points out her record on the border, talks about her being the border czar, and runs clips of her interview with NBC with Lester Holt from about 2 years ago, where she appears to be somewhat dismissive of the border crisis. And the ad ends with failed, weak, and dangerously liberal is how he's describing her.
And despite all of the attacks on her, her portfolio included the border, but it did not include stopping the crisis. It included finding ways to have those countries from which those people were coming solve their internal problems. Don't know how successful that was, but we do know that border crossings are at their lowest in years.
And you also saw her, this week lean into that and talk about the Biden campaign and the president, how they tried to pass meaningful bipartisan legislation along the border the last few months, but that according to reports, it was all scuttled because of President Trump.
So this is the time, every 4 years, television stations around the country, particularly in key markets and particularly in battleground states like ours, ton it. They make a lot of money on political ads. How much money are the Trump and Harris campaigns planning to drop in North Carolina on ad buys? Do we know?
Well, we know the Harris campaign at just $50 million between now and the DNC, and that's just a few weeks away. A lot of it's going to depend on how tight this things get. You know, all of our bosses are going to be really hopeful that it gets really tight all the way up to Election Day.
Yes,
and you can't fault them either. I'm not hating on that either.
Alex, Kamala Harris's candidacy has infused Democrats with enthusiasm. And here in North Carolina, after losing voters for a number of years in terms of voter registrations, just in the last 6 months, they lost a lot of voters. Western Carolina University political scientist Chris Cooper reports that the Democratic Party is now witnessing a bump in voter registration. How much of a bump?
There was a 44% increase between July 20th and July 26th. 443 more registered Democrats in North Carolina in that week.
Is that significant? I mean, we have a big state here. 443 people doesn't sound like a lot.
It doesn't sound like a lot. I think the reason it's interesting, though, is like you said, they've lost voters every week except for except 1 week since the beginning of February. So that's why it's kind of just showing that there's a little bit, there is that momentum going. Like we've seen that in fundraising dollars with the Harris campaign, and now we're starting to see it a little bit with voter registration. I don't know if that trend will continue or what will happen, but it is interesting to look at.
At the same time that voter registration for Democrats seems to be on the rise, as you said, that they have gone up in the last week or so, 44% increase week over week. What may be more significant is the number of new voter registrations for Republicans and unaffiliated voters. I think unaffiliated voters are the largest group of voters in the state, and those numbers are down. Number of Republican registered voters, new voters registering as Republican, down 24%, 14% down for unaffiliated voters. What does that tell us?
I think it could just tell us that people are, well, we're seeing the voter registration bump because of it's summer right before presidential election, and then we're seeing people maybe switching parties or positions and things shuffling around a little bit.
So the presidential race underway. We'll keep our tabs on that going. We'll be talking about this for the next 3 months or so. In just the last few weeks, we've been talking about serious progress being made on the Red Line commuter train from Davidson to Uptown because Norfolk Southern has finally agreed to let us use the O-Line tracks for that train.
This is transformational, something we haven't been able to deliver on in decades. It's finally, the way I see is this dream, the vision is coming to reality.
That's City Councilwoman Dimple Ajmera. Of course, there are some things that have to happen, including the City of Charlotte agreeing to a deal with Norfolk Southern and the delivery of a plan to fund the line. And now there's a little wrinkle in the works because some people on council aren't really happy with some of the aspects of this. When we come back, we'll talk about all of that and the prospects of a red line coming to fruition and what it means for the other parts of the transit plan. Ann Doss Helms is here from WFAE News, Ben Thompson from WCNC, Joe Bruno from WSOC-TV, and Alexandria Sands from Axios Charlotte. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte. Using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks and the local news roundup on 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We've been talking about the red line now for years, and there's some movement on the red line that just came about in the last few weeks. The city council will meet, I think, beginning of September, Joe, and have a vote on this plan that they're going to how they're going to figure out how to do this, build this line, and whether or not to pay for or pay Norfolk Southern for the line and how much, et cetera, et cetera. You got your hands on the PowerPoint presentation that City Council will see in September. What did you learn?
Yeah, so August will kick off this debate and discussion of the red line in public. Starting on Wednesday, there should be a special transportation committee called where they will go over a lot of these details. But the red line right now, they're eyeing a September 3rd vote to purchase the red line to, you know, like have the debate and discussion and raise their hands and say we're going to buy it. And then on September 9th is the targeted closing date. On September 3rd, they're hoping to also vote on a resolution in favor of the sales tax increase, which will be needed for the commuter rail.
According to the PowerPoint presentation, as I understand it, the draft legislation breaks down the sales tax this way. 60% for transit, 40% of that would go to rail, 20% to buses, 40% of the remaining 40% would go to roads. The General Assembly has said our plan is too transit-centric. More money needs to be spent on roads. Will this make them happy?
Yeah, because it's only 40% rail. With that 60% transit, that includes 20% for buses and roads. You know, if you look at the whole package, I think this is what the General Assembly had in mind. And when we say road projects, it isn't just for cars. Bike facilities are included in that roadway package, as well as sidewalk improvements, signal improvements, things along that nature. But, you know, it'll be interesting to see what the timeline is for these rail projects, which ones make the cut. Will they have enough money to fund them all? We already know that the Silver Line to Matthews is being re-envisioned as a bus rapid transit project. Is that going to be enough? Like, will the other projects make it through? Those are the types of conversations we'll be having.
And you're not the only person who has seen this PowerPoint presentation. A Republican City Council member, Tariq Bakari, who describes himself as being in the minority, which he is, of course, because there's only two Democrats in city government that we know of, two Republicans in city government that we know of. He's seen this and takes issue with something we talked about a couple of weeks ago, because part of this draft legislation would create a new transit authority for the Charlotte region to run CATS. It would include all kinds of members, several of which would come from state government, and he takes issue with that. Why?
His issues are the way it was crafted. I think he wishes he had more input into this process and feels like a lot of council members are taking a back seat to this, and this is a staff-driven proposal, and he wants to know, like, who is involved from the General Assembly, and, you know, is this really just Marcus Jones going behind all of council's back and working on this, or should they have been brought into the process? What the city has told me is there are working groups that include council members that have had a say in this draft legislation, and it is still a draft. Things are being finalized. There isn't consensus on the language. So all of that can change still.
Go ahead.
I think Marcus Jones is probably walking a little bit on like a tightrope here, because he said how he's having like discussions with the other towns in Mecklenburg County, and he's probably trying to rebuild some of that broken trust because of the red line never happening and the northern towns not really benefiting from the red line. So I can see how there could be frustration with some of those discussions going on behind the scenes, but also maybe the city manager seeing those as necessary while they try to work out those kinks and rebuild the trust.
Ben.
Also, you cannot overstate, for those of us who might not follow the ins and outs of transit on a daily basis, you cannot overstate how far this has come over the last 10, 15 years. I mean, I remember when the Blue Line first opened up and covering that. But it's been very clear to me in the last 5 to 10 years talking to any of the stakeholders that nobody was going to move forward on any other rail project without buy-in from the other towns and other parts of the county, that it was too big a deal and it was going to require too much of a lift and require the General Assembly, that everybody else was very clear they're going to have to involve other stakeholders.
Well, that leads me to this question, because the red line, the folks in the northern counties said they are not voting yes on the 1 cent tax increase, sales tax increase for transit, unless a train to their area is part of the deal. And to make this deal, evidently, they're going to have to do something with Silver Line, and the existence of that Silver Line from Matthews to Belmont, or exactly how far that line will go now, is up in the air. Has there been any pushback from that area about that potential?
Yeah, I remember the mayor of Matthews, when this first came out a month or two ago, he expressed his disapproval about this, that just like the folks in the northern suburbs, he wanted transit, he wanted rail as well. I think the little sliver of Silver Line that might remain would be from uptown to the airport, because a lot of people feel like, why would you go through all of this and then not get some sort of transit out to the airport? Although, as of right now, it wouldn't actually go to the airport. It would go a mile away from the airport.
Which is silly. And actually counterintuitive when you consider that we have one of the busiest airports in the world. The Charlotte Observer is reporting that Tariq Bakari, City Council's Tariq Bakari, says that elected officials are generally frustrated that they have not been more involved in these negotiations. And now he says he's willing to make sure the upcoming votes don't go through without assurances that elected officials will play a major role in crafting a new governance model for transit. Is he going to be the squeaky wheel here? Is this just a negotiating point? What is this?
I think we should let the discussion play out on Wednesday and see what the city has to say. I'll go back to what I said earlier, that the city feels like they have been keeping elected officials in the loop, and they're stressing that nothing has been decided, nothing is set in stone. And I think in a lot of ways, once this is out in the public, it will be easier for elected officials to maybe have more of an influence if that's what they desire.
Okay, well, we'll keep our eye on that. More developments to come. In recent years, Anne, there was a string of alleged rapes and sexual assaults reported at CMS schools, and the system has been pretty quiet about most of these. But this week, federal judges rejected an appeal from a former Myers Park High School student over an alleged kidnapping and sexual assault. This case dates back to 2018. What did she allege?
I think it dates back to 2015.
Okay.
It's taken a long time to work its way through. This was two students, a 17-year-old female and an 18-year-old male. They skipped school. They left the campus walking by a school resource officer, walked into the woods. A sexual encounter happened out there. She reported it as a sexual assault and said that she was not protected. She was not listened to when she reported this. And these kinds of things are usually worked out in private settings, which is why we don't know about them, or we only hear when there was quite a spate of people coming to school board meetings and saying this is a problem. But this one went to a jury trial in January of 2023, and 4 days of just heartbreaking, painful testimony about what played out there. And the jury did rule that CMS did not act with deliberate indifference, which is what it would have required for them to be held liable in this case. And now what's happened is that the plaintiffs appealed. This was known as the Jane Doe case. The Jane Doe plaintiff appealed, and the appeals court also sided with CMS. Having said that, it's not like CMS was covered in glory with this. I mean, I think there was very wide recognition that the system was flawed. The principal and I think the assistant principal who were there at the time were replaced probably in connection with this. So it is an ongoing question as to how they deal with these. You know, this is not teachers assaulting students. This is two teenagers doing things where there is pressure, where there is confusion, where there is just a really difficult situation. And they're still, I think, working on that.
And there seemed to have been a spate of these allegations over a period of time that, as I said, CMS has been very quiet about over the years, and that's probably because they can't speak about impending litigation. So this federal appeals court found in favor of CMS and upheld the ruling of the lower court. Will this now be appealed to the Supreme Court, do you think, or is this done?
I don't know. I know that the school board had a special meeting that was related to a different, very kind of perfunctory issue, and they spent 90 minutes in closed session, apparently because their attorney was briefing them on the latest development in the Doe case. So they know, but I don't know.
We'll come back to education in a moment because there's a lot going on as we get ready to go back to school here. Charlotte has a plan. We've had one for years to reduce traffic fatalities to near zero by 2030. It's called Vision Zero, but a report shows that things aren't going too well. Again, City Council's Dimple Ejmera.
The report is pretty clear that we are failing the residents of Charlotte. Not having a structure in place is concerning because this plan was implemented back in 2019.
So where and why are we falling down on the job, Joe?
Quite a few places. An internal audit took a look at the Vision Zero program, found out that the city hasn't put a person in charge of the Vision Zero program to oversee it. I found out that CMPD isn't really doing traffic enforcement on the roads that have the most fatal wrecks or serious injuries tied to wrecks. And it says that city vehicles are even parking on sidewalks and blocking bike lanes, contributing to the unsafe conditions. And it took issue with how police are coding some of these crashes and how they are reporting the data to them. So it's making it hard for CDOT to keep track of. And it was a big wake-up call for a lot of city officials.
So let's unpack a little bit of that. Fatalities they're not going down. In fact, they are rising. There were 81 deaths in 2020. In 2022, the number rose to 125. And this report says, quote, "The city is finding it difficult to undo decades of automobile-focused development to increase all road users' safety." What have they been doing to mitigate those risks? What would an average driver, pedestrian, bicyclist recognize in terms of changes to make things safer over time?
Some of the road diets, like the Plaza and Plaza Midwood, going from two lanes to one, putting in protected bike lanes in Uptown, making it easier for neighborhoods to request speed bumps, and reducing the speed limit in the city from 35 to 25 on roads that don't have a designated speed limit. Those are some of the examples of Vision Zero initiatives that have been put in place since 2019.
So this audit has been scathing. It's been described as scathing. It says the city hasn't implemented many of its own recommendations. It hasn't designated a single person, as you said, to oversee and coordinate this program, which has created a lack of accountability. This is coming after millions of dollars have been spent on this effort. How much money have we spent on this?
Tens of millions?
Tens of millions. And the audit
Tens of
goes on to
millions, I'm sorry.
say that that while you talked about the police, while Charlotte has identified high injury roads that account for most fatal crashes, CMPD traffic enforcement doesn't focus on those areas. Instead, they distribute enforcement evenly throughout the city. How do they explain this? How does CMPD explain this approach? Or do they?
CMPD didn't really comment on the audit more than what they said in the audit, which is that they're going to make changes. They are going to follow the recommendations that the auditors found. I'll let Alex go.
Okay, Alex.
I was going to add that it's interesting that this audit came out, I think the same day that the New York Times had an article on how there's been an increase in road deaths. This is happening nationally, but in Charlotte, there's been a 27% increase in road deaths from 2019 to 2022, but traffic stops have gone down 35% from 2015 to 2023. So this is happening across the country since the pandemic. Traffic stops are not happening as much, and we're still seeing we're seeing more road deaths because of that. So I think that's interesting too that this is all kind of happening simultaneously.
Ben.
Yeah, I mean, you're talking about your tens of millions of dollars into this. You're also 5 years in. We only got 6 years to go. This is supposed to happen by 2030. I mean, that's a lot of pressure that we're going to put on ourselves as a city. After 5 years of Italy not having any progress, actually going backwards, I also think it's important to, for people listening to this, to sort of jockey two ideas in their mind that just 5 minutes ago, we were talking about being less road focused, or right now we're talking about less road focused, while the General Assembly, when it comes to issues, wants us to be more road focused. You would be understandably whiplash trying to keep track of which way our city's moving forward.
This is an international effort, this Project 2030, this Vision 2030 thing. It started, I think, in Sweden in 1997. It's been implemented in various places around the world. Do we know how those other cities are doing with this effort to reduce traffic fatalities to zero, which sounds like an outrageous and impossible goal, but a laudable one, I suppose? Do we know how they're doing?
The city of Hoboken? Did I say that right?
Hoboken. Hoboken, New Jersey. Hoboken.
Yeah. Just across from Manhattan.
The Cake Bosses, Buddy's Bakery. They have had no traffic deaths over 7 years. They are the epitome of success of the Vision Zero program. They widen curbs. That was one of the big things that they did, was widen curbs and make sure that their signals are timed properly. But you know, that's a very pedestrian heavy city as well. Up there, a lot of people live there and commute in New York every day. But they have not had any traffic deaths in 7 years, which is very impressive.
Bike Walk NC's Terry Lansdell told WSOC-TV that the city needs to get serious about the Vision Zero program.
It's a wake-up call for the entire department to get out of their silos and start managing the programs, initiatives, and funding that we have in place.
And Sustained Charlotte's Eric Zavert told Channel 9 that we can only go up from here, and says the city needs to double down on its efforts to make streets safe for everyone, not just motorists, but pedestrians and bikers.
We really need to focus on transportation options and choices beyond that mode of transportation and making it safer, prioritizing safety above all.
But here's where things get sticky. And I think, Joe, you mentioned this, or one of you mentioned the fact that we're talking, the legislature wants a more road-centric transportation plan while we can't implement this. And part of the problem appears to be that the state controls about half of the major roads in Charlotte, meaning we cannot implement the changes that we'd like to, because in some cases, the North Carolina Department of Transportation, this is a quote, actively opposes those changes. The audit reports that 62% of serious injuries and deadly crashes happen on state roads. So is there a solution to this? I have 30 seconds. Is there a solution to this? Is the state going to get on board? Are they listening? Are they paying attention? Do they care?
The current administration is very clear up in Raleigh that they want to focus on roads and expanding the roads, which I'm not sure falls in line with this.
Wow. All right. Well, we'll come back and talk a little bit more about this. I mean, then we have a lot of things to talk about with regard to education, vouchers and teacher raises and more. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks in the Local News Roundup on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Ann Doss Helms is here. She's our education reporter for WFAE News. Ben Thompson joins us from WCNC-TV, where he's an anchor and host of their Flashpoint program on Sunday mornings. Joe Bruno is with us. He's a reporter and an anchor and host of their political beat at WSOC-TV. And Alexandria Sands, reporter for Axios Charlotte. Before we move on from Vision Zero, despite this lack of progress toward accomplishing the goals of Vision Zero by 2030 and this audit, which did not contain very much good news, Mayor Pro Tem Dante Anderson says the city is taking the audit to heart.
I think what it will do is it will ignite us to double down on our commitment to Vision Zero.
But if 62% of the accidents take place on state roads over which we have no control and NCDOT doesn't want to cooperate, are we just, I hate to use this as a word, are we just spinning our wheels here?
I think one thing that's not being considered is if we get the sales tax increase and it is passed and we're getting all this money for roads, will the state allow some of that money to be used on state roads? Will there be a desire for Charlotte to try to do so, considering that the state really isn't funding those projects much anymore? Charlotte has funded state transportation projects and bridges in the past, so it's not really out of the ordinary here. But the complete streets that would be built if the sales tax passed might be something to consider along this topic.
And as we've talked about many times, the General Assembly expanded the so-called Opportunity Scholarship Voucher Program this past year to include any student who wants a voucher to attend the private school of their choice, no matter the economic situation that their family finds themselves in. And the demand was so intense, they had to pump more money into the program, but the bill that would have added $248 million to clear the wait list has stalled, and now some families are losing hope. Why?
Well, this is really an odd one, because leaders of the House and the Senate said, we support this, we're going to do this. And this is, of course, both are dominated by Republicans. This was not being held up by the Democratic governor, who does very much oppose this, but they can override his veto. But the two chambers of the General Assembly couldn't agree on how to pay for this, and so they adjourned without a budget. So there will be opportunity scholarships, but if there are going to be increases so that everybody who's on the wait list gets them, that's going to have to happen in September. They're coming back from the 9th to the 11th, and there are some people who are saying, come on, y'all said this was going to happen.
And this waiting list contains students and the parents of those students who would normally have qualified for this before the demand increased so much, and probably would have gotten them, and in fact, maybe it did in the past, as well as newcomers who want on because they just want into the program. And one of the parents with children on this list is Rachel Brady. She was among many who went to Raleigh to make their displeasure known.
We're here to put faces and handprints to this issue and to ask our leaders, we're here to support you. We applaud your school choice efforts, but we are not going to be forgotten.
And she added the parents were told by the General Assembly, quote, time and again, we're going to get this done. They did not keep their promise. How many people are we talking about here? How many people are on this waiting list, waiting for vouchers?
Oh, I don't have those numbers in front of me.
Right.
I'm thinking,
is it a lot?
50,000? Yes, it's a large
okay.
number. And everybody who got one last year will continue to get it. The people in the lowest income tier were all covered. But yes, they did run out of money in that sort of middle tier. And then everybody who's in the upper income, basically what they said with last year was, we're going to open eligibility to everybody, no matter how much money your family is making, no matter whether you already have your kids in private school. But first priority goes to the lower income families. And so it's now some of those middle income and people in the upper tiers who are saying, you know, the original legislation said we might not get it, but you all came back and said we were going to get the scholarship. So follow up.
So Rachel Brady, the mom we just heard from, hand-delivered a letter to outgoing House Speaker Tim Moore, which asks for more funding. But Moore has said that funding is not likely to pass before the new school year begins, and he says that Governor Cooper is likely to veto it. Of course, they could override that veto easily, but he did hold out some hope.
What we ought to do is we ought to take this up while we also enhance with the surplus. Additional funding for the traditional schools.
Is that likely to happen?
You know, apparently that's been some of the holdup, is that Tim Moore wants to have the vouchers and additional raises for public school teachers. And they have not been able to come to agreement with the Senate on this. So, yes, there's a great deal of frustration across the board from people who care about education, the ones who support choice and want vouchers for private schools, and the ones who want to see public schools strengthened. And by the way, that's not a mutually exclusive group. I think there are quite a few people who, like Tim Moore, think both ought to happen.
And you report that CMS officials are urging parents to lobby for better teacher raises, because when he talked about the traditional schools a minute ago, Tim Moore, he was talking about the public schools. And in fact, members of the Charlotte-Mecklenburg School Board say that they're going to spend the next 5 weeks urging legislators to approve bigger teacher raises. Talk about that, Ann.
So they passed the 2-year budget in 2023, and As part of that, teachers this year would get raises averaging 3%. It depends on where you fall on the experience scale. Could be more, could be less. That's less than inflation. And I think there was a widespread expectation that in an election year, they were going to come back and increase that. And in fact, the House did, and the Senate didn't. And again, they adjourned. So unless they change it in September, they get the smaller raises.
Yeah, the House voted in June to raise teacher pay by 4.4% on average. The Senate disagreed. The state inflation rate is 3.8%. So the teachers are going to get 3%, and that is a pay cut. Charles Jeter, who is a former legislator and who is now the CMS board staff's liaison to the General Assembly.
The people who suffer the consequences of the inaction of the North Carolina General Assembly this summer are the 9,000 teachers at CMS and the roughly 90,000 teachers statewide.
So what is CMS? I know there's a committee that voted to go to the legislature and ask for raises. What are they asking for? How much?
They are asking for they're asking for 5% across the board raises. And in their discussion, Charles Jeter told them, that's not going to happen. That's not really the way that the state does it. But they said, well, we need to ask. We feel like everybody ought to get at least 5%. But I think they would be happy with a 5% average increase.
Is
and
this
the bottom
just
line
coming...
is it doesn't really matter what CMS asks for. It's going to be what the General Assembly agrees
well,
on.
Well, is this just coming from CMS or are other area school districts or other urban area school districts like Guilford County and Wake County asking for something similar?
I haven't been following their school board meetings, but yes, of course they are. Everybody wants bigger raises for teachers. And this is coming at a time when a lot of the additional stipends and bonuses that came from the COVID aid are going away. And we're competing with, you know, South Carolina, Virginia. And I haven't done a survey, but one of the things that they discussed in this CMS panel was that we are falling behind. We used to be ahead of neighboring states, and now North Carolina is falling behind, which is a really big deal in an area like ours where you can live where I live and drive very easily to South Carolina.
Yep. This is all coming as school is about to start. We're just a couple of weeks away from the start of school, at least at CMS. Not in Mooresville. They've already started, or they're going to start school this coming Wednesday. They're flaunting state law by doing this. And we talked about this last year. Some school districts are ignoring the state law. They're not following the school calendar that the state sets up, and they're starting and ending school on their own terms. How are they getting away with this, and why are they doing it?
There's no teeth in the law. They just, if you defy the law, they send you a letter and say, you shouldn't do that. And I think a lot of districts, probably most, if not all districts, think it's better to start earlier, give exams before winter break, come back, start second semester. The state says, no, the only way you can do that is to have a very short first semester. I learned something this morning because I realized that the South Carolina schools, some of them have started back this week, some more will do it next week. And apparently South Carolina also has a similar law. Their official starting date when people are supposed to wait for this year is August 19th. North Carolina's is August 26th. And apparently South Carolina districts are doing the same thing. They're like, yeah, no, we don't want to do that.
Okay. We talked about the need to lure people back downtown in recent months because of the desertion of uptown as a result of the pandemic. Office towers have high vacancy rates. Many businesses in uptown are suffering. You would think that would force the city to find ways to lure people back into uptown. And one of those would be to make parking easier, but no, they just decided to extend the charging for street parking uptown and in South End until 10 p.m., Joe. This began, well, it begins, what is today, the 2nd? Began yesterday. Why are they doing this?
The main issue, it's a more of an issue, I would think, in South End right now, because that's where most of the nightlife and people heading out and about is right now, but people have been just leaving their car for long periods of time. It used to be even worse because they would stop charging for parking at 5 p.m. on Friday and people would park on the street and just leave it there until Monday morning because nothing would happen to it. So the city is viewing this as a way to churn through those spaces faster to provide businesses with relief so that people have a place to park if they are going to some of these restaurants or businesses in South End and Uptown. So that's how the city is approaching this.
So is this a Monday through Sunday kind of thing? $1.50 an hour?
It's Monday through Saturday until 10 p.m. Okay. And we'll see what enforcement looks like. You know, I don't know how. I'm sure as it starts, it'll be pretty strictly enforced. But over time, you know, look at the light rail, for example. Hardly ever is somebody on there checking for tickets. Yeah. We'll see if parking ends up that way, too.
Meanwhile, two pedestrian bridges have opened at Charlotte Douglas this week, connecting the main terminal to the hourly parking deck and to rental cars. Charlotte's CLT's chief infrastructure officer, Jack Christine, explains why this is important.
We think it should have a really good impact on the passenger vehicle lanes, the private vehicle lanes, which are the outer five lanes that we won't have customers crossing in front of now. People still stop and pick up and drop off on those five lanes, so you still have traffic. It's not like the traffic is going to go away. But it, you know, being able to efficiently move that traffic and not have to worry about the customers crossing is the goal.
So give me the lay of the land here. Doesn't span all of the lanes of traffic, just some of the lanes of traffic. It goes from the fifth floor of the parking deck to the airport. Does it service both departures and arrivals? How does this work, Joe?
I'm going to be curious to see who uses it and for what purpose. You know, at one point they were talking about moving ride shares to the hourly parking deck. I could see the sky bridges being an appealing option if that becomes the case in the future. It is kind of awful, the airport most of the time, when you're trying to, you know, move around as a pedestrian or be picked up for a ride or even just try to access the terminal. So if this can improve the passenger experience even slightly with the pickup and drop offs, I think that's a win, but we'll see how popular this new amenity gets.
Mecklenburg County District Attorney Spencer Merriweather in the news a lot this week. And I know, Ben, that you followed him to Rock Hill to learn about a new homeless court program. What is that all about?
Yeah, that's right. We're airing our piece this Sunday at 11 p.m. on WCNC. And right now, there's about 2,800 people experiencing homelessness in the city of Charlotte. That's the latest numbers from this summer. South Carolina cities are actually piloting a program that they call, for lack of a better term, homeless court. This basically allows those who are willing to get treatment, those who are trying to get their life on track, to have minor charges wiped from their record. So we're talking about things like trespassing, possession, that sort of stuff. Because those charges can derail a person's chance of getting housing, getting a job. So we actually followed the DA from Mecklenburg County down to Rock Hill recently to learn more about it. Now, he warns that our court system in North Carolina is set up very differently. So not everything's going to be applicable, but he's hoping to take a few of those things to help address the situation here. We should say we do have recovery courts here, not quite the same as homeless court.
And Alex, you reported on a development at Eastland Yards this week. After many, 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 many years of waiting, the first housing units at the old Eastland Mall site have begun construction. This is the first phase of the project. What will it include?
Well, the affordable senior living housing, that project, that building is almost finished. I think they're just doing work mainly on the inside now. And then if you drive by Eastland, you can see that they have a really good base going now for the second housing building, which is going to be more like workforce apartments for people that could, it's going to be market rate, but the target audience is going to be people who, you know, have just workforce jobs. So yeah, I just wanted to give an update on that because along with all these other things that Charlotte City Council is going to be dealing with when they get back from their summer recess that we've talked about, like Vision Zero and the Red Line and all that.
Right.
You can expect a discussion about Eastland and specifically that the 29 acres that has been like the big hole in the plan for well over a while now.
Yeah, a long time. They're going to build 70 units of affordable senior living, 274 workforce, 4 rent apartments, and 150 market rate for sale houses and townhomes. When will they just started construction? When will the first units become available? Do you know?
So the senior living people can start moving in October.
And finally, the Summer Olympics continue in Paris. And I know that Ben Thompson, because you work for the NBC's local affiliate here, you're concentrating on the four athletes from the Charlotte area who are performing or competing. And several of them do so today.
I am your official Olympic correspondent who's still in Charlotte, not in Paris. Today we got Sarah Burdick. That's right. No, not at all. Sarah Burdick, she went to Butler. She's playing this morning the basketball 3-on-3. Kaylin Brown, track and field. She went to Mallard Creek, mixed 4x400. That's at noon today. Sanu Jalo Lockhart went to West Mech. She's up today at 1 o'clock. And then Ebbie Liebhardt, we've covered her a lot in the last few days. She trained over at Whitewater Center. She's coming up at about 40 minutes at 10:40 for cross kayak.
Look at that. Promoting NBC and Peacock right here on our air.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Anytime. Ben Thompson's an anchor at WCNC TV and host of their Flashpoint program on Sunday mornings. Joe Bruno, a reporter for WSOC TV, host of their Political Beat program on Sunday morning. Alex Sands with Axios Charlotte and Andos Helms from WFAE. Thank you.
Celebrating 25 years on the air, Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Wendy Herkey. The senior producers are Gabe Altieri and Sarah D'Elia. Our engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.